There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back, listeners of the 45th podcast. Rabia Chaudhry here, and I'm here with my co-host, Susan Simpson. Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rabia.
We also have a very special guest on this week. I'm so excited. And for those of you who follow us on Undisclosed, Susan and I, you are familiar with him. He is the host of our addendum oftentimes. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. John Cryer.
Yeah, that's what he's most known for, is hosting our addendums.
That's how the world knows him.
Setting show business on fire, hosting the Undisclosed.
So, addendums. Yeah, we talk a lot about our cases for Undisclosed on our addendums there. But we also tweet a lot about politics. So the other day I was like, you should come on our other show and talk to us there as well.
I promise I won't call you Ducky, but that's
Thank
how...
You.
I hear people know you by that name. I don't know why.
It does. It tends to undercut my seriousness when I'm talking about, you know, the decimation of our State Department and things like that. It just doesn't. It undercuts it somewhat.
Ducky does reflect poorly sometimes on Undisclosed, I have to say, but it's okay.
I was also Alan Harper. You know, that's a little more legit.
That's very, very legit. That's Emmy-worthy legit.
I got to be honest. I would much rather have Ducky tell me about criminal procedure.
Yes, Ducky pontificating is a little more fun.
Well, let me first wish all let our listeners know that, you know, we weren't here last week, and we hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and also you, Susan and John, hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving. How was it?
It was great. I'm going to eat a lot more still of a canned cranberry sauce.
Delicious. How was yours, John?
Mine was magnificent. It was tiny, just my half brother and his son and my family, and it was just perfect and wonderful. However, my wife is an amazing cook and Instagrams to much acclaim her dishes, but then she gets gripped by this cleaning fever, which is great for me because she cleans like a maniac after the dinner, and she threw away the drumsticks. Exactly.
You have to leave her. I'm sorry.
I know. Exactly. I should not be dragging my wife on a podcast. I shouldn't, especially considering she made the dang thing. She can do whatever she wants with it.
Precious, man. Those are, yeah.
Maybe she fed them to Norman and didn't tell you.
I know. Oh, I wondered why Norman was so fat and happy.
I want to know how you discovered that. Was it like the next morning when you're like rooting around? How'd you figure that out?
It was the next morning, and she did say it somewhat shamefully. What happened was she realized that there was a lot less leftover turkey than usual. That's what Thanksgiving is famous for, having an enormous amount of leftover turkey. And then there was very little. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I guess everybody hit those drumsticks really hard. And she was like, I kind of threw them away. and so, like I said, what happens is she, not only is she a magnificent cook, but she also needs things to be super clean. She's the person who takes out the garbage every night to make sure that there's not anything that she can smell in the morning. She's awesome. But it has a downside. So sadly, we do not have as much leftover turkey as we had hoped.
Well, we have something else to be thankful for this Thanksgiving, and that's Mueller's investigation. Seems to be progressing.
Yes.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of news this week. Well, first of all, I want to tell our listeners we actually have another special treat this week. Having John Cryer on is one big one, and the other one is that what we've been promising you for a long time is Susan Simpson's deep dive into all things Russia is here. But before we get to that, and it's amazing what she's put together, we're going to talk a little bit about what happened this week, a little, you know, some news stories that might have caught your eye. We want to talk about this new development in the Flynn story. Susan, if you want to tell us about that.
Yeah, well, what we know now, I think it broke actually on Thanksgiving Day, is that apparently what seems to have happened is that the attorneys for Mike Flynn and the attorneys for Trump had a joint defense agreement where they could share information and like prepare for the case and not lose attorney-client privilege. At some point, and it sounds like on Wednesday, so pretty recently, Flynn's attorneys told Trump's attorneys that they can't talk to him anymore. And that could mean a lot of things. We don't know how the full scope of it yet, but what it definitely means is that Flynn is at least exploring the idea of some kind of deal with Mueller.
Now, my question is, okay, a joint defense agreement, besides sounding like super like a some sort of nuclear treaty, what makes that legal? I mean, so that's just an agreement between the lawyers?
Yeah, there's
nothing. Or between the two clients?
There's nothing like that's just a very standard thing. You have to do it because you often have, especially in white-collar cases, you have complicated cases, lots of interest, lots of people involved. Because you have a corporation doing something, it's a typical white-collar case. And you've got all these executives, you've got all these players, and their attorneys have to be able to work together. Now, the problem would be that would cause loss of attorney-client privilege in most cases, unless there's some sort of deal like this, which means that the attorneys can communicate without losing it. And it's totally legit. There's nothing wrong with that.
What's weird to me about this kind of arrangement is that other than the attorney-client privilege stuff, what about like a conflict of interest? What if your client... there's a couple of different defendants in the case and there's different attorneys representing them. And, you know, there might be conflicts of interest between the different defendants because you want to get a deal and you might have to throw somebody under the bus and you might have to rat somebody out. And then how does that, how do you even negotiate around that if you agree to all be defending some, like the whole group together?
It's complicated and it's always an issue to watch out for. And no, there's never really a case, not indeed, like basically you're never in a case of any kind of complex level that where everyone is exactly aligned and everyone's interests are identical. They're not. Like, people do have their own interests. There's always a chance someone can, you know, try and cut the line and get a deal for themselves and say, see ya to everyone else. And that's why joint defense agreements typically have like clauses about this saying, like, if something happens, you have to tell us and you have to stop the joint defense agreement here. We're no longer share strategy or communications between us.
And that's what's happening right now with Flynn, right?
Yeah. So, but again, we don't know what triggered it. Like, we don't know. It could theoretically be that the agreement between them was that if someone actually does like get very close to a deal, that's when it triggers. Or I could have said, if you start talking to them at all, if you even like whisper the word to Mueller, get me a deal, that ends it. So we're at least at that point. We're at least at the point where something happened. There was some kind of possible communication between Mueller and Flynn's team where they said, let's think about this. But it could be farther along as well. It could actually be that he's like about to do like sign the thing. And that's what, it just depends on how their deal was set up.
And do we know exactly when it was terminated? Was it just terminated this week? Because I you know, it wasn't clear from the article exactly when this occurred.
Wednesday, it sounds like.
Oh, okay.
So very recent, which means what we do know now is that there was, I think we can say we know for sure there was no deal before this, or at least no deal affecting anything to do with Trump. But now there's one in progress, which we're always going to be, because like Flynn has been the guiltiest and most obviously guilty from the start. And moreover, his son as well, his genius son, was in the same boat.
Yes.
So like he had lots of reasons to cooperate.
Yeah, his son really compromises him. But also, you know, whatever stage they are in terms of coming to some kind of plea deal, it wouldn't just happen for nothing. I mean, Mueller is going to get something out of it, right? And that's what I'm wondering is like, what is Flynn able to offer him to get this plea deal?
Yeah, that's I mean, like, that's the big question, because again, Mueller's not giving up any freebies. He didn't even give poor little Papadopoulos a freebie. He still made him like plead to a felony. No one, except for the very lowest of the low, is going to get off with nothing. And even then they have to offer a lot to do it. So, but the thing is, you know, people keep saying that Flynn is the key of the whole case, and maybe he is, but I think that's... The strongest evidence against Flynn is about stuff that theoretically Trump could dodge. So, and I guess it depends a lot on what else there is we don't even have a clue about yet.
Well, but whatever it was important enough for him to fire the director of the FBI over.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, unless he's just, you know, trying to help out a friend, which is obstruction of justice, by the way, you know, it seems awfully big.
Well, it could have been what they're investigating Flynn for was one thing. And what Trump's fear was is that Flynn knows where the body is. So they get him for this other stuff he's on the hook for. Then he'll start talking about all the other stuff that he knows about and isn't public yet.
Which makes me wonder, by the way, why do you think Trump hasn't fired Mueller yet?
You know, I'm kind of surprised he hasn't. I guess he knows the fallout would be incredible and he's not ready to risk that yet. He also probably, you know, to the extent he is capable of learning, realized that firing Comey didn't go so great for him. And that may just make things worse in the long term. But I think at some point, like if and when things get really serious, I mean, he may decide he has no choice.
But it cements obstruction of justice once again, he's again trying to dodge getting fingered himself in this situation. I'm sorry, by the way, I sound like a broken record here and on Twitter with my constant obstruction of justice thing.
It is. And in a normal world, that would be the end of it all. But
yeah.
And I think recently, just in the last week, the news came out that that Mueller's team has requested all communications related to the firing of Comey, right? Like from the White House, or I think that's what I...
No, from DOJ.
Oh, from DOJ, right. So I do think obstruction is going to probably a big one. That might be what brings him down. It's the cover up, right?
Yeah. And I mean, apparently, like, there was a lot. I mean, Stephen Miller wrote the first draft of that letter, and I'm sure it was pretty remarkable.
Oh, God. I would
Oh, my God. I would love to read it. Hey, John, if we get that letter, you got to come on for a dramatic reenactment.
Oh, I would love it. I can't be that oily and awful at the same time. I don't know if I'm capable of it. I'm good, but I'm not that good.
You like dead on the inside, basically.
I know. Exactly.
If you're looking for seasonal gifts that are guaranteed to bring holiday cheer to all the special people on your list, well, don't look any further than harryanddavid.com. Now, I love treating my friends, family members, and colleagues to the amazing and delicious gourmet goodies that only come from Harry and David. In the last couple of weeks, I've gotten two of those shipments, one actually for myself and my own family, and one for my sister's family. They make a beautiful gift because they come stacked in this beautiful gift tower. All the boxes are like wrapped separately, and you open them up, there's like little surprises inside. So, for example, I had one box full of these really just juicy, delicious, almost melt in your mouth English pears. Another box had these chocolate covered cherries, caramel popcorn, these cheesy crackers, and this delicious and really beautifully wrapped Wisconsin cheddar. It's a great, great gift, and they're really packaged beautifully. And right now, Harry and David is offering you guys, all of our listeners, 20% off your holiday purchase. Because remember, the holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, it's all around the corner, so you better hurry up. Whether the people you love are chocolate lovers, late night snackers, even wine aficionados, or a holiday hostess, Harry and David has something for everybody to love. And 20% off your holiday order is an amazing deal, but guess what? You have to hurry because it expires on Friday. Now, Harry and David is part of the 1-800-Flowers family of brands, and they are the company that I go to for all of my holiday gift giving and entertaining needs. So to get 20% off select holiday favorites now, just go to harryanddavid.com. That's Harry, H-A-R-R-Y, the ampersand, and david.com. Click on the radio icon and enter the code 45. That's harryanddavid.com. Click on the radio icon and enter code 45 for 20% off today. And hurry, because once again, the offer ends on Friday.
Before we move on to the Russia deep dive, I just wanted to quickly ask, John, anything else you want to talk about this week? Anything that's happened in the last week that's newsworthy thought you'd want to mention?
I just, the day after Thanksgiving something happened that I was forever grateful for, which was Trump's tweet that Time magazine called to say that I was probably going to be named person of the year like last year, but I would have to agree to an interview and a major photo shoot. I said probably is no good and took a pass. Thanks anyway. I'm sorry.
He is the neediest person. He is so needy.
He is so needy. I'm sure he has a beautiful girlfriend in Canada. I'm sure there's a lot of wonderful things that he just doesn't want to tell us about because they're just so great.
He cares so much about this. Like,
I know.
Like, I still look at his old tweets just to see it. Like, it is incredible how much thought and care he has put it. Like, he like every year he is obsessed with it. I think he thinks it's like the award for like the winning human, like the human that won this year. That's why he doesn't realize like what Stalin's on the cover.
Well, I think
parents must have just really neglected. I just don't know what this is like really deep. His neediness is beyond like anything I've ever seen in anybody. I don't know if anybody, or it's complete narcissism. I don't know which one it is.
Well, I think it is neediness, and it plays into a lot of things. I mean, actually looking at simply as neediness is generous to Donald Trump. Vanity Fair had that great deep dive into him revealing the intelligence incredibly hard sought intelligence to that was won by the Israelis and that he divulged to the Russians, you know, off the cuff. And And in the article, it took pains to say he might have just said this because he's super needy and insecure, as opposed to a traitor.
But like, can you rule it out? Not really. I mean,
no. There's no. I mean, I love that. That's the nice reading. You know, that's trying to be.
But you know, Time's response to that tweet was also kind of odd to me. They didn't really clarify one way or the other if they actually had made a phone call. Any of it happened. It was just kind of a.
Because sometimes he does both make up phone calls and then like totally like reinvent how phone calls had actually happened, how they went. Like with the when he made up the phone call about the Boy Scouts of America, like that thing never happened. He just claimed Boy Scouts of America called him up and was like, "Yeah, we love your speech, dude," and like there was no call whatsoever there.
Never tell. Sometimes this stuff is based on things that actually occurred. It's possible that they tried to set up a photo shoot for him and said, oh, you might be Man of the Year, you might not. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's possible that happened.
And then there's Congressman who, I forget, God, looking at the name right now. It was just back at the beginning of his term. And Trump came out and said, yeah, he said that I was the best president America's ever had. And I was like, no, he didn't. And it turns out what he said is like, if he had talked to him and said, hey, if you do these things, if you care about this, if you really follow through in this, you could be like one of America's greatest presidents. Which, of course, in Trump's mind, like, I already am.
Yes. Done. Mission accomplished. Okay, so the tax bill is moving through.
Yeah, now, it's now, going pretty fast.
Yeah, and now does it or does it not? It's not yet clear to me. Does it remove the individual mandate for Obamacare?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so interestingly that's not getting an enormous amount of coverage at this point, especially during a semi-quiet week, I guess because Thanksgiving was in it and people were sort of in the mood to just block it all out and not listen to the horror for a moment. But, you know, that could decimate the vestiges of the Obamacare system, you know, what is functioning could well be decimated by this thing. And so if you're out there and if you care about it, please call your representatives because that is part of the tax bill and it will handicap the Obamacare system completely if it passes.
And to our listeners in Alaska, for the love of God, call your senators. Mostly one of them.
Yes.
I will say this, though. I was always a little bit conflicted about the tax implications with the mandate because – you know, I do know people who couldn't afford to get insurance and they also couldn't afford to pay that penalty for it. And it was really hard on them. And I understand, like, you know, creating that mechanism to ensure people enroll, but some people still couldn't. I don't, you know, how they're going to handle it. You know, then you don't pay your taxes and get other penalties and it rolls over. It's just... So I don't know. I feel like that might be a selling point for the GOP, that they're getting rid of that. But
the people who fall on, I mean, they're such a small percentage of people who do fall on that hole. And it should be fixed, should be addressed legislatively. But that's not exactly a very large percentage of the electorate who don't get subsidies.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is this, what we're not accounting for is people who don't qualify for subsidies, right? Like they make enough money, but they have expenses that are so, you know what I mean? Like they have kids in college and a mortgage or they have whatever, healthcare, like all kinds of expenses that... leaves them in a position that they still can't afford certain things.
Like healthcare,
right. I mean, like, so there is, a population that still gets kind of screwed either way because they don't qualify for the handout.
It disproportionately hits people not in poverty because they're generally not taxed at all, but right above there. And it, you know, I understand that. The problem is, what always infuriates me about this is Obamacare was designed by Republicans. It was designed, the idea that became the ACA started all the way back in the Nixon administration. And this is a Republican version of as close to possible as universal health care. You know, this is not what the Democrats wanted to do. The Democrats wanted single payer. They, you know, that was Hillary's thing all during the 90s. The history of this is just so twisted and contorted and horrifying that Obama said, you know what, I'm going to reach across the aisle and I'm going to do their idea. I'm going to take their idea because that will at least get a lot more people insured. It's not, you know, it's relying on private insurance companies. And my whole thing with private insurance companies is, you know, unless they thought they could make a whole bunch of money, they wouldn't do it. So, you know, this is always going to be a money-losing proposition for people using private insurance to insure all of the United States. So that being said, Obama said, I'm going to take the Republicans' idea. I'm going to tinker with it. And that way they will finally support getting, you know, millions and millions more Americans health care. Well, of course, we saw the Republicans twist it into, you know, this horrible system that, of course, they invented. And that has been one of the most remarkable pieces of political jujitsu that I've ever witnessed. It's horrifying.
I mean, it screwed them over, John, because that's why they're not able to come up with anything else. I mean, that was it. They've never had an alternative to Obamacare because that was their plan.
It was their plan.
It was their plan, yeah. So they have nowhere else to go from there, in a way, other than just taking it all away. So
that, which is what they're trying to do. And obviously the individual mandate is very tough on some people. You know, obviously most people, you know, if the system had been functioning as designed, if it hadn't been hobbled by Republicans at every turn, merely out of spite, they've hobbled it at every turn. And it would be functioning a lot better if they had not. But it only, you know, it's all about political expediency. And that's disgusting that, you know, Republicans should be revolting against their leadership because their leadership did this and it's horrifying and it's disgusting that they twisted them this way. Republicans, you should be mad. I can't believe that I lucked out as being the guest on the one where Susan Simpson breaks down Trump Russia. I am like peeing in my pants with excitement.
Well, before you get too excited, there's still a lot we don't know. But what I really thought was important is that there's so much has gone on, so much has happened. Trying to put it all in your head in one comprehensive whole is really difficult. So even if we don't know how pieces fit together, just laying them out, I think, is helpful for everyone to understand what the roadmap is and what we're looking at right now.
And I'm hoping that you make this available to our listeners. Susan created this incredible chart that completely lays out what she's found. It's gorgeous, and it is so detailed, and it's pretty damning. I feel like Mueller needs to be in touch with you.
And this is a fairly comprehensive summary of what's been out there, but obviously I don't think a single chart could contain everything we know so far. But to do a brief run through of the background here, here's what we know about Trump and both Russia and his presidential ambitions. He's wanted to be president for like ever, basically. So the first we hear from Trump's presidential ambitions is really 1987, planning for the 88 election. And I thought it was funny that even then, even the articles written at that time mention how Donald Trump is in need of approval and validation. And that his run for election seems to be fulfilling his craving for like public affirmation of his brilliance, and how he grew up the fourth of five children, so therefore he's always, you know, needed more love. But his Russia connection started about the same time. His first trip to Moscow came in 87 after he got a letter from the Soviet ambassador, and it said, "Hey, we want to do a hotel with you. Come to Moscow to visit us." And he did. And that was the first of many trips over the years. But even before that, and have y'all seen this about his like early statements about how he was going to solve the Cold War crisis?
No. And interestingly, I mean, the Cold War was winding down at this point. If you recall, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. So, you know, if he's going there.
Sorry.
No. I'm the oldest one here. but in 1989, and then the breakup of the Soviet Union was in 1992. So this all happened in fairly short course. So obviously, Don was on it and taking care of business, clearly.
Yes. He had this plan to. In 84, there's an article on him. You should definitely read it, where he got a reporter and he said, "I want to talk to you about my plan to solve nukes." And he's like, "I can negotiate. I'm the best at it. I'm going to go negotiate so we, you know, don't have nuclear war." But his plan was pretty specific. It was, in fact, the goal would be to join teams with Soviet Union, and that we are both superpowers. We have nukes. Let's join up, team up to rule the world together.
Okay. Yeah.
This is the man who says in the same article that it would take an hour and a half to learn everything there is about missiles.
Yeah. But Trump hasn't changed. Like, so from in February, he had his first, like almost his last solo press conference as president. And he said a lot of crazy things. But his statements there show he hasn't changed since that 84 article.
I know that we're going to make a deal. I don't know. We might not. But it would be much easier for me to be so tough. The tougher I am on Russia, the better. But you know what? I want to do the right thing for the American people. And to be honest, secondarily, I want to do the right thing for the world. If Russia and the United States actually got together and got along, and don't forget, we're a very powerful nuclear country, and so are they. There's no upside. We're a very powerful nuclear country. and so are they. I've been briefed, and I can tell you one thing about a briefing that we're allowed to say, because anybody that ever read the most basic book can say it. Nuclear Holocaust would be like no other. They're a very powerful nuclear country, and so are we. If we have a good relationship with Russia, believe me, that's a good thing.
One thing I just want to mention is this is the guy who has always claimed he's this amazing negotiator. Since his election, has he negotiated anything?
He negotiated both a second scoop of ice cream and a Coke button.
The Coke button will be his legacy, as far as I'm concerned.
I'm going to install one of those.
Yeah, watch. They're just going to call that a Trump from now on. It's like, oh, just press the Trump for me.
I don't think they're going to call it that.
He claimed that he got the basketball players out of China through his mastery of negotiation. But literally, is there anything else?
Well, he's doing some stuff in Saudi.
Oh, yeah. He did negotiate that seems to have negotiated that crazy semi-coup.
Right. In the recent Thomas Friedman article, which, by the way, made me want to vomit, that was all a big PR article that he interviewed the Crown Prince guy. And so, he was like, this couldn't have happened without Trump. Trump was the right guy at the right time, and yay for Trump, and now we're going to be in a reformed country. So he can take credit for that, because that guy's given it to him, I guess.
Okay. Well, I stand corrected.
It was that orb, the magic.
Yes, it was the orb is kicking in.
Well, unfortunately for Trump, he both his presidential ambitions and his Russian hotel ambitions fell to the wayside, as he had some pretty serious financial issues in the 90s. So he didn't, as far as I'm aware, he didn't really have any serious developments planned for Moscow or for anywhere in Russia. And he didn't really seriously run for office again until 2000, when he actually had his first election. It didn't go great.
He ran for something?
Well, I think he already dropped out of the election before, but he was still on the ballot in California for the primary. He was under the Reform Party banner. But he had lower approval ratings than Pat Buchanan. So also he screwed up paperwork and couldn't get on the ballot in New York. So I think he is like, well, you know what? Let's try again next year, next 4 years.
At the time, he was thought of as just an obnoxious New Yorker. I recall it at the time. And everybody, sort of wrote him off as that, as opposed to, Pat Buchanan, who everybody thought was, an incipient Nazi, So
it's still better. I mean, I
it's
can't
still better. Yeah.
But Trump's attempts to get a tower going in Moscow continued all through 2000. I think 2001, 2002 is when he hooked up with the Bayrock Group, who is run by some a Russian American mobster and a ex-Soviet, serious mobster like the Felix Sater has his ties, but he's nothing compared to Tevfik Arif. And so Tevfik Arif and Felix Sater are trying to get a deal going in Moscow. It doesn't work for a lot of reasons. Probably the most important one being in the whole thing was a scam from what it looks like with the tower they were going to build and sold pencil factory. But in the lawsuit that Trump brought against author Tim O'Brien, he claimed it was because Tim O'Brien falsely stated his actual net worth was only $300 million. And once everyone in Russia found that out, they're like, we're not going to deal with you, Trump. So that all fell apart, yeah.
He was not sufficiently wealthy?
Apparently. That's why all his deals went away. It's because someone lied about it and everyone believed it.
Well, yeah, if that has been the thing about New York papers have for years been saying he was always a house of cards, that there was never substantial assets behind the constructions that he did and the towers that he slapped his name on that he didn't actually build, and that it was all bull. Of course, then we in Hollywood took over the mantle and promoted him as the apprentice maker. Yes, exactly. It is in many respects. We thought it would be fun. He's fun.
We thought it was ironic.
Yeah, we thought it was ironic. Oh, get a shot of him getting off a helicopter with his name on it. Oh, they'll love that. And they did, and they bought it, and to this day, people think he's just a business genius, and he never was.
Never. And then that brings us to 2008. And he's trying to run the whole time. He doesn't run then either. And what was interesting is, at the start of 08, he seemed to, be, not totally anti-Obama. First year or so, he had some actually, I think it's time for change and maybe he'll do good and good luck to you, Obama. And then very quickly, though, it did turn to, birtherism and everything we've seen in the past, during the 8 years of Obama's tenure. But in 2012, Trump was considering running against him. I think Trump knew he could never win against Obama and that he had some very recent skeletons in his closet that were more relevant then and would have come out, although in hindsight probably wouldn't have mattered. Like his business partner being caught on a yacht with underage women, like children that he'd sex trafficked, so things like that. And
yeah, that doesn't go over well. Although, again, you know,
maybe
when
it would have. Who knows?
Yeah, when you latch onto white nationalism, it really, you know, that carries you a good way. I mean, I should do that. I should do that.
See how far it seems.
Well, let's just see what happens, guys. This will be a cool experiment. Nobody will hear this.
I feel like your co-star may have taken that route. See how that
went
for
him. You're right. So yeah, okay.
So this is 2012, Susan, right? But 2011, wasn't 2011 that...
It was post-Palin. It was post-Palin then, so I think it could have worked, but...
No, I'm wondering about that, the impact that White House Correspondents' Dinner had on all of this, because I felt like that... People say that was the moment that Trump was like, I'm doing this. When Obama...
Guys, he wasn't really mad. His book just explains it. He actually enjoyed all of it.
Oh, is that right?
He wrote that, yeah. He's like, yep, I thought it was really great. I was not upset at all. In fact, I thought it was funny.
Well, he was the center of attention once again, and we know how well that works for him.
But again, 2012, he decides against. He tweets out that, I'm sorry, my fans, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to run. But then, starting about February 2013, Trump gets in this thing where for like 2 years, he retweets everyone who tweets to him and says, Trump, you should be president. Like a shit ton of tweets. Like 1 month, I only counted 1 month, and there was 150 times over that he'd done it.
Who the hell are these people?
Well, it turns out I was wondering that too. So I started looking at them. A couple of them had actually done it as a joke, and they're like it's 2013, so they're like, I just thought it'd be funny to be retweeted by Trump. And some were real, apparently, but a lot of them were bots. Or if they're not bots, they're people who literally the only thing they do for fun is retweet like ads from like the corporate accounts of Trump hotels. Like seriously, he like there's people that who tweeted him probably 10 times, you'd be a great president, and Trump would retweet them. And you look at their account and all they do is like go to like Trump hotel, like Trump Soho or like Mar-a-Lago's Twitter accounts and start retweeting shit from there.
They are bots that they paid for. I mean, like anybody can pay for that crap. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it was bots and they were, you know, praising Trump and he bought it. This is when we get the first possibly relevant Russia-Trump contact for the 2016 election. And that is Miss Universe 2013 in Moscow.
Which is amazing. I mean, it's a beauty pageant. And by the way, it's a dumb beauty pageant. I mean, if you ever watch the thing, you just go, oh my God, what a waste of time.
Are there less dumb ones now, I'm wondering? I've never actually seen it.
It's awful. It's a beauty pageant. I mean, they're all dumb.
Susan, you've never watched the Miss Universe pageant?
Why would I ever watch that?
Okay, I'll be honest. We grew up watching WWF or WWE, whatever it's called, and Miss Universe. Those were like staples in our house. We watched a lot of until I got grown enough to realize this isn't really unhealthy. And I
yes, it's really
it.
Gross the
yeah,
way
it's
that
pretty gross. It's pretty gross.
The thing. Yeah, I mean, it's just it's meat parade is what it is. And don't get me wrong, you know, as a guy. You know, there's a certain enjoyment of meat parades. That being said, that this could be the place where something so disastrous to the United States could be birthed is just so bizarre and it's kind of perfect. It's just so wrong.
Well, here's my theory for how it happened. And I'll disclaim this. This is just my theory. I haven't seen anyone else actually like prove it happened. But what I really do think might have happened here is that what we know from Emin Agalarov is that he came to the U.S. and had a music video where he wanted like Miss Universe winners to, you know, dance around behind him or something. I don't know. For music video. Who knows? From that evolved, he started talking to like Trump Organization people. And apparently, and Trump Organization denies this, but apparently they were in debt or the pageant was in debt. And the idea comes along and there's a dinner between Rob Goldstone, remember that name, the Agalarovs and Trump in June 2013. And they decide... Let's have it in Moscow, Miss Universe 2013. What I think happened is I think this was all a scheme for Emin Agalarov to boost his like failed pop star career. Legit, because his father, Aras Agalarov, is a Azerbaijani Russian oligarch with like bajillions of dollars, lots of money to spend, and Emin wanted to be a pop star. And Trump's always bragging about how his pageants like have boosted the careers. Like he claims Lady Gaga is his creation because she sung at one of his pageants and that's why she's famous. Maybe Emin believed him and it's like, you know what? If we pay Trump to have his pageant in Moscow, I can sing at it. I'll be featured in all the stuff, which he was. and then my career will begin.
It doesn't actually, I mean, things like this happen all the time.
Rich people that want to be pop stars, like, buy a pageant.
It absolutely does. It happens all the time. You do paid gigs. What people forget is people in show business are hustlers. We just need funding for the next gig all the time. You know, and so this kind of thing is not atypical at all. And very often people don't care where the money comes from. I know, Susan, you're involved with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations at your law firm. The movie business is just rife with them because it's often the producers. If you lose money, it's money laundering. Plus, it's got this, the patina of glamour to it that is often hilarious. And this kind of thing happens all the time. But clearly this had another layer to it because relationships were being formed here that ended up being very important.
Yeah. So there's like a slight possibility that the downfall of America can be attributed to a Russian playboy's pop star ambitions.
Yes.
But we know. So what happened is, Trump has always been a big fan of dictators. So it's nothing new here. But in September, just before the November Miss Universe, Putin wrote like an op-ed and it was put in the New York Times for some reason. And Trump like goes out like crazy praising it and saying how awesome it was and how embarrassed the U.S. embarrassed Obama, made him look like a school child and like really hit it and was going on all those stupid like cable shows to, talk about it. So already he's like super favorable about Putin. And then he goes on a show and says, I invited Vladimir Putin to come to the thing. I hope he comes. Oh, and also don't forget his tweet where he wrote, do you think Putin will be going to Miss Universe pageant in November in Moscow? If so, will he become my new best friend?
The answer is yes.
Yes. the thirstiness magnifies.
And then, November 8th, it's a short trip. November 8th to 10th, he goes to Moscow. He has dinner with, the Aguileras and, and a bunch of bankers and executives. He does the whole pageant thingy. Maybe I'll watch that pageant just to see. My only pageant experience.
Well, wasn't there an elaborate signing ceremony where they actually signed an agreement or something? Or was that at an earlier time?
There could have been. This point. but later he'll claim that he met with all the oligarchs and they all loved him. It's hard to say how true that is. We know the bankers like Sberbank, a few of them they were there. So there were some big people there. Supposedly, Putin did not show up and he did not meet Putin. But there's a lot of weird comments from 2013 and Aguilera of interviews where they kind of reference like people ask him, it's 2013, people are asking the Aguilera, hey, did Putin meet Trump? And he's very kind of coy about what he says. So I wonder if there's more of a story there. What we do know, and this is pretty recent, is that while he was there, he was staying at the Ritz-Carlton Moscow. And according to his bodyguard, he was in the White House, but then had to leave for not getting paid enough or something. Keith Schiller, who testified recently for Congress, someone offered Trump 5 women, but he turned them down. So nothing happened there.
That sounds like a lot. I have to say, that honestly, I'd be like, can we just trim it? I mean, that's a lot.
You draw the line at 3, John, right? You draw the line.
So, and of course, this is, if you're trusting the Steele dossier, this is where the infamous PP tape comes from.
And again, I don't care if I don't care if he enjoys having people urinate on him. Great. Knock yourself out. I really don't. That does not whatever floats your boat.
Just don't make us watch it.
Yes. Don't make us watch it. The idea is that this is blackmail. That is the only thing, a lot of people get all excited about the pee-pee tape because it's funny, it's funny. We get to say pee-pee. Yeah. But really, there is an important thing here. Later on, I the idea of Putin having leverage over Trump is what this is all about. Is there something that Putin has leverage over him about? And to me, though, I always thought that money laundering was always a much more obvious area for Putin to have leverage over than
he has all of it. I mean, there's probably no PP the PP tape. I mean, I'm agnostic towards it. It probably doesn't exist, but that doesn't mean. I think the odds are very, very high something does exist. I mean, look at Trump himself has made comments over the years about how politicians have stayed at his hotels and implied that he has leverage over them for it. So it's clearly the dots crossed his mind. And really, does anyone think that Trump could have made all these trips to Moscow and not done something totally incriminating in the place where they're actually filming him? Because he would have, hands down.
Well, I think his behavior after this, you know, totally seems to indicate somebody. By the way, folks, he still hasn't enforced the sanctions. Remember, Congress forced him to do it. He has not done it. So, you know, this is amazing.
And you remember the Access Hollywood tape? He knew he was taped. That, like, he knew he was on mic and he still said that shit. So he's not restrained. And the fact that he was in Moscow wouldn't have stopped him from doing stuff that would, you know, get leverage over him. And while there in Moscow, he talked about with the Akhlyarovs and some of his U.S. partners about having a Trump Moscow. Again, for whatever reason, it's not clear why exactly, that never happened. But they talked about it. They had, you know, like, we should do a deal. Yeah. Never went through.
Probably because he's, like, broke on the inside.
Like, well, he's not. That's the thing, though. He doesn't need money to do what he's doing there. All the money's coming to him. So then we go to 2014. And again, Trump is, like, retweeting a couple hundred tweets a month of people saying, you should be president. And he's all, yes, I will fix everything instantly. And that's not really an exaggeration for how it responds. Wait, here's one of them. He says, someone said, can't wait till Donald Trump is president. And he retweets it and says, I don't blame you. Things will get really good really fast.
See? And he's totally right.
Everything's good now.
Everything's good. Except my wife threw away the drumstick. Other than that, things are great.
The one thing you can't blame on Trump.
Yes.
And then in 2014, Russia goes into Crimea. And Trump, who was doing sort of the pre-election, you know, speaking circuit, references this several times in speeches he gives. And he is always very favorable towards Russia and says some pretty scary things. He talks about how he was in Moscow and he got treated so great there. And Putin sent him a present with a beautiful note, a pee pee tape, a copy for himself.
Just a little something.
Yeah. But he talks about how, like, the Ukraine, it's going to be, the Crimea is going to be over really quickly. And that, you know, like, good for Putin. He's doing everything he should be doing. He's having a great time over there. So already, Trump is kind of like showing that he's totally cool with Russia's expansionist ambitions.
This aligns with his idea that we should be taking all the oil from every place we, like, you know, take our military. So it's, like, this is just his philosophy. Basically loot, whatever you can is how he, you know. That's his foreign policy.
Yeah, and interesting, he's not the only one making those kind of comments in 2014, because Sam Clovis, who will become his national co-chair, is also making similar sort of statements about, you know, Russia's just taking Crimea back. It's actually, it's not, for the record. But then, end of 2014, Trump gets more serious about his run. He starts registering, like, campaign websites, says he's seriously considering it. Then early 2015, we have Trump makes a presidential exploratory committee. Like March. And interestingly, in April, he goes to the NRA convention in Nashville. And while there, he, according to Alexander Torshin, meets with this Putin ally and NRA enthusiast. And apparently they have a conversation there. Now, I think Trump's denied this happened, but Torshin said it happened. And there's no reason to really doubt him, given what happened later. And then in June, we have the escalator journey to hell, where Trump announces his candidacy.
In front of paid supporters, by the way. Yes. The people that were there were extras, basically, that were bought and paid for to cheer for Donald Trump as he came down the escalator.
Yes. And also in June, we have the beginning of the election social media campaign from Russia, where they start buying ads to cause chaos on many levels, or try to. I'm still skeptical about how effective it actually was. But the efforts did begin in June. Also in June, we have General Michael Flynn, who, as far as we know at this point, was not yet hooked up with Trump. We don't know really how that origin story began. But he was busy traveling in Egypt and Israel to promote investment interests involving Russian, like, Saudi power plants funded by Russia. And a pretty complicated deal with a group called the ACU, but more on that later. But what's important is that Flynn does not disclose this trip and these payments and these associations and later disclosures, both for a security clearance and for financial disclosures after Jones to the White House. And also Sessions was involved in this deal as well. Lesser degree, it seems like, but, you know, something to look into there.
But again, why? You know, all of the players in this situation seem to only leave off these meetings. It's very oddly selective. again, it indicates that something of great import was happening that, you know, or you know, their claim has always been, oh, these were things of no great import, and that's why I didn't put them down. But it just seems it's very telling that these are the only things that they left off.
And what Flynn was doing isn't, like, in itself was not, like, wrong. Like, there's nothing, like, he was private. Yeah, he was a private person then. He had, like, consulting business. Like as far as I know about the deal, what I know about it so far, like, there's no reason he shouldn't be doing this kind of stuff. But, and this is kind of where I think things, the bigger picture here, and we can't get into all of it right now because I think it's a pretty complicated situation. But this whole thing Flynn was involved in the summer of 2015 is a pretty complicated scheme, but it really isn't just investment. In order to pull the investment off, there's a really serious sort of diplomatic, like, foreign relations component to it, and is that the goal would be to make money by severing ties between Russia and Iran, by focusing Russia on other regional partners. I mean, it's a very ambitious and complicated scheme, and to pull it off, they would need not just, like, the financial component, they would need the foreign policy component as well, which I think may sort of be the genesis of some of what was happening, at least with regard to the power plant deals.
And these wouldn't be things that necessarily would be antithetical to American interests either. America has been, as an entity, trying to deal with Iran in various ways, and, you know, perhaps trying to wedge it away from Russia would be helpful in this situation, perhaps. Again, so it's saying that there's nothing necessarily wrong with him doing that. So again, why would he leave it off his declarations?
Yeah. And that brings us into July. And already at this point, I think we are all in collective denial, but Jeb Bush and Donald Trump were the forerunners in a field of 17 candidates for the Republican nomination. He was dominating the polling from the start. And probably because, again, 17 candidates and name recognition is going to go a long way.
Yeah. And he had the TV show and he, you know, but again, I figured he's dominating the polls now, but he's not a politician. He says stupid things all the time. That will trip him up eventually. Right.
I think we all recall 2012 and, like, oh, I remember Herman Cain was, like, winning for a little bit. So clearly it doesn't mean anything.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It doesn't, you know, all that stuff. There's no reason to take all that stuff seriously at the beginning. You know, and plus he had a small group. And then let's remember, he didn't really win the election. You know, he won a freak electoral college victory.
Yeah.
You know, that's what happened. Let's not pretend he ever had a mandate. He did not. You know, he got lucky, you know, and, you know, maybe the Russian disinformation campaign helped. Maybe
I think
it didn't.
We'll get into that.
We'll get into that later. But
I think it undeniably did. Well, we'll see. But I think it's far too soon to conclude it didn't. Again, during this time, we have Trump bragging about all the times he's, you know, had Russian business deal. He's done great in Russia. You know, he's in a Scotland trip to see his failing golf course there. He talked about how he had major business in Russia and had great relationships with people there, and that Putin hates Obama, and that me and Putin get along just fine. We also have Sam Clovis join Trump's campaign. He had previously been on Perry's sort of campaign, but he left Perry and joined Trump in August, which is interesting because, like, a month before, Clovis had been writing some, like, really scathing emails about Trump, like calling him, like, basically the destruction of the, he called him the cancer of the conservatism, and that he'd, like, no one who says he has nothing to be forgiven for by God, it, like, should be president. So he did, like, a really quick 180 there to join the Trump team.
Where did you get these emails, just out of curiosity?
The Perry campaign. After Clovis ditched him, they made those public.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, I assume that's what it is. I don't know if that's been, I mean, that's definitely where they came from. That was definitely a revenge leak. And also during this time, we kind of have the field get narrowed. So by the end of the summer, early fall, we're looking at, like, six real contenders. Trump, Carson, Rubio, Fiorina, Bush, and Cruz. Meanwhile, on the Russia side, we've got Cozy Bear, which is the hacking group that seems to be associated with the FSS, sort of the, you know, modern day KGB. They start their hacking spree. They gain access to the DNC servers and apparently lurk there for a year. We have more social media ads coming out. And again, like, you should, I hope we would get to see more of what they did. But I think it's really instructive to see what kind of ads the Russians were running.
Well, it seems like they weren't straight up trying to support Trump yet. It didn't seem, it seemed like they were trying to merely sow division, because there were ads, it seemed like, on both sides of issues, just inflammatory ads. Mm-hmm.
That was always, I mean, it's always been their goal. And again, they were trying to, like, boost sort of, like, not it's like the kind of knockoff Black Lives Matter movement. And it's purely aimed at like increasing visibility of like disruption, a discord. And I think you can see sort of that happening now with Trump's constant tweets about ungrateful Black athletes. Sort of the same thing, like trying to make it visible to like people in the heartland being like, hey, look at all these ungrateful Black people who are rising up. You should be angry at them. Like, I think that's really sort of the strategic connection there. So what Russia was doing is what Trump's doing now. Meanwhile, Flynn is getting more money from Russia. He got almost a little under $12,000 from a sort of a Russian air freight company, which again, he does not disclose like he should. And then we know from the campaign disclosures that Flynn is now in contact or in cahoots in some way with Trump because they reimbursed him for travel expenses in September of 2015. So by this point, whatever way, they're claiming there was no real relationship there yet, and it was just a, you know, a visit or something. But I think there's a good chance that Flynn was really starting to join Trump team and be part of the operation.
And this was when Trump was still claiming he was self-financed at that point for his campaign.
He was self-financed the whole time. He's, I think by this point he's put in, wait, I've got a spreadsheet right here. I can open it. Through October, he had loaned $2,800,000 to his campaign. So kind of low-level money at this point.
But at some point, didn't they start a super PAC that was going to help him? And, you know, he claimed he was self-financed, but then it turned out he wasn't.
Well, he was self-financed from what we know from the beginning. He was loaning money to his campaign and through the primary.
They were loans, though. They were loans. And so then they collected donations and he got paid back, right?
He didn't get paid back. There was concern he would, but as far as we know, he didn't. There's a lot of weirdness going on in the whole campaign financing. So at this point, yeah, he's put at least almost $3 million of his own money in it. And this is when we have the Felix Sater and Michael Cohen emails, which there has got to be more to come here because it's... So what we know is that in September of 2015, Michael Cohen, who is Trump's personal attorney and long-term business partner, very close to him, begins to talk to Felix Sater, who is also Trump's business partner, but is also sort of an outside guy who has his own Russian business interests and his own Russian companies. And Trump begins to negotiate. Trump World Tower Moscow, I think they called it, for construction to begin soon, with one of Sater's old business partners, a guy named Andrei Rozov. And we don't know all the details there, but have y'all read what was written there by Felix and Cohen?
I have not. But it was just a licensing deal. He wasn't actually going to build the tower, right?
He always does that. They're always, like, really favorable. Basically, Trump puts no money in. And in this deal, like, it was like that. He, you know, he gets, I think, probably, like, $4 million up front. And then he gets a cut of, like, all the sales. And he gets a cut of all, like, the business transactions. So, like, he doubles up there. He puts none of his own money in. Everything he pays is reimbursed. If he pays anything, it's reimbursed in some of the company. It's a risk-free deal from his perspective. But what we know is in October 13th, 2015, Sater writes to Cohen, and he says, here's attached the LOI, have Trump sign it. We know Trump did sign it. And he says, let's make this happen and build a Trump Moscow and possibly fix relations between the countries by showing everyone that commerce and business are much better and more practical than politics. That should be Putin's message as well, and we will help him agree on that message. Help world peace and make a lot of money. I would say that's a great lifetime goal for us to go after.
That's the master plan right there.
Apparently.
But by the way, not necessarily evil. You know, the idea of strengthening business ties that perhaps commerce will keep us at peace is not, again, necessarily evil. It only becomes evil later.
Well, but it's not even evil yet. It's just weird and like concerning because like Sater writes, I'm going to get Putin on this program and we'll get Donald elected. I mean, how cool would that be to get a USA president elected? And he's like, my big plan here is I'm going to be ambassador to the Bahamas. Once we get Trump elected, he's going to point me there. I'm good to go. And I'm not kidding, by the way. That's actually his plan. But like he tells Cohen, I'm going to arrange for Putin to praise Trump as a businessman. And if Putin says the word, we own this election. That's his word. We own this election. And then he writes other weird stuff, like in a November email. Michael, we can own the story. Donald doesn't stare down. He negotiates and understands the economic issues. And Putin only wants to deal with a pragmatic leader. And a successful businessman is a good candidate for someone who knows how to negotiate. Business, politics, whatever, it's all the same for someone who knows how to deal. Michael, I arranged for Ivanka to sit in Putin's private chair, his desk, and office in the Kremlin. I'll get Putin on the program. We both know no one else knows how to pull this off without stupidity or greed getting in the way. I know how to play it, and we will get it done. Buddy, our boy can become president of the USA, and we can engineer it. I will get all of Putin's team to buy in on this.
Did you say Ivanka sat in Putin's chair?
Yeah. So at some point in 2008, a lot of the Trump kids, I don't know if Eric went, but Donald Jr. for sure went, and Ivanka went to Moscow to check out a Trump Tower deal there. And according to Sater, Trump sent him along to babysit, basically, which might be true. He was like, I don't want my kids going alone to Moscow. Felix Sater, convicted violent felon and mob guy, please go watch over my children.
But yeah, there's photos of them together. I mean, that's
and apparently Ivanka sat in Putin's chair. Now, so there's a lot going on here. And the thing to keep in mind is that Sater is a con artist. He's been a con artist for a long time. That's what he does. He does occasionally make real business deals too, though. But we don't have the full communications here. We don't have the full picture. We don't know how this plan connects to both the tower and to getting Putin's buy-in and getting Trump. Like, I don't know what the scheme was here. And it could just be that Sater was talking out of his ass and trying to like make money for himself on a quick deal. I don't know. But it's weird. And again, this is Trump's Cohen. I mean, Sater's close to Trump, but Cohen is super, super close to Trump. And there is no way that Trump's personal attorney is told, I'm going to get Putin on this and we're going to make you a president, Donnie. And he doesn't pass the message along. No way.
Yeah, especially since Trump himself has been just constantly beating the drum, on Twitter and in his public statements. It just defies belief.
You know, what's interesting to me is I'm listening to you like describe how these people are approaching the situation. It's not so much like we're going to get this guy in the door and he's going to be a puppet for this dangerous, Russian dictator, but they actually really believe that he will be a good president. That's what it sounds like. It sounds like they believe he's a businessman. He's a deal maker. It's almost like they really sincerely believed in Trump in a way. And then maybe Putin thought, well, I can take advantage of this idiot type of thing. I don't.
Cohen would believe that. I don't know if Sater really does. I mean, Sater's heart. Basically, it looks like Sater convinced the CIA that he could help them track down bin Laden and get him bin Laden's stolen cruise missiles, which I think was all a lie.
Yeah. No, he knows what people want to hear, clearly. Yeah. That's what con men do. And again, show business is full of these people.
Felix Sater had gone into Hollywood instead.
Exactly. Well, yeah. And you have a couple of legit projects and you have a bunch of other things that are just sort of bubbling. And, and it's all smoke and mirrors. This does not surprise me at all. He's blowing smoke up Trump's ass. He might have actually been, connecting with Putin and the FSB and perhaps influencing them to say, you know what, this might be a situation we can take advantage of. And by the way, I don't believe for a minute that Felix Sater actually thought, this is going to be he's going to be a great president who's going to help the world. You know, he's going to be a great president who's going to make things very lucrative for me, is what he clearly felt. But he wanted to blow smoke up his butt.
But clearly already there's this bromance happening between Putin and Trump. There's articles Putin loves Donald Trump and Trump is retreating them happily. Russia and the world has already started to respect us again. And again, keep in mind what Sater said to Cohen about he'd get Putin to praise Trump. Well, a few days in December, that's what happens. Putin makes a statement. Now, the translation here kind of garbled things because what Putin really said is that he is a sort of a talented person without any doubt. He's the leader in the presidential race and all this stuff. But the way it got translated was as brilliant. And Trump took that as yes, Putin says I'm brilliant. But the word was more like not brilliant smart, but brilliant like a really gaudy bird.
Colorful. He's colorful, yes. Which yes. He is.
Yes. So it was not quite, it was more restrained praise than Trump took it as. But Trump was all over this. He's it's always a great honor to be so nicely complimented by a man so highly respected within his own country. I've always felt that Russia and the United States should be able to work well with one another, rah, rah, rah. So again, they're starting this bromance off. Meanwhile, in December as well, we have another more direct Russia contact. And that's when Flynn goes to the RT Russia Today gala in Moscow. and is seated right next to Putin at the table. Jill Stein is there, too, because why not?
Yeah, again, that is of incredible importance. You know, I've been to the correspondents' dinner. I didn't get seated next to George Bush, you know, and then there, you know, you don't, these things don't happen where you have access to somebody on the level of Vladimir Putin without a lot of things going on.
Putin has better things to do.
Exactly.
Unless there's more to it.
People in that kind of power, their time is incredibly valuable, and every moment is scheduled. It's not like they were just hanging out at a dinner. You know, that's, you know, if he's seated at the right hand of this guy, there is real significance to that.
Mm-hmm. And we know that Flynn was in his own, like, for the own people, his own, like, context. They were giving him a lot of shit for this. They weren't happy with what he was doing. First, him going on RT for an appearance and, like, trashing the U.S., and then accepting this invite from Russia. The invite was made on October, like, 13th, actually. So at the same exact time that, you know, we got Sater and Cohen, like, plotting to get Putin on board for this tower deal, they're reaching out to Flynn, who has previously met with Trump, and has previously, we don't know the full extent of it, but is already Trump-connected. And saying, hey, we'll give you $45,000 to come to Moscow. Actually, they had to negotiate that. Apparently, Flynn wanted more, and they had to talk him down a bit. But he got $45,000, and he didn't report this, and he was very evasive in interviews for a long time about it. But what I found interesting is that in I think early December, he tweeted out, regarding RT panel participation, know my values and beliefs are mine and won't change because I'm on a different piece of geography. Which is clearly responding to people in his life who are very critical of his decision to do this.
Yeah, and $45,000 is a substantial amount of money. Did he categorize it as a speaking fee?
Well, he didn't categorize it as anything at first. Okay. But he did, yes. And he didn't get permission for this, and he didn't bring it up in his 2016 security clearance. Like, he knew that this was, like, people were clear, he knew that there was something possibly dodgy about this. And he was defending his decision to do it anyway and saying he can still be an ethical person. No, you can't, for the record. But also, a side note here, at the same time that Flynn is in Moscow, we've got the NRA also in Moscow hanging out with the bigwigs, including Sheriff Clark, because the Russians have been courting right-wing interest in America for a long time and succeeding in it.
Again, courting division. For some reason, because what possible, the NRA is a political action group in the United States. What possible nexus of concern could they have with the Russian government? I got nothing.
Russia is white and Christian, and they don't have any minorities or immigrants, and they're not granting gun rights yet, but they want to go there. So they don't really want to go there. I think they're pretty sure that's what the Russians are telling them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Putin doesn't want his people getting guns in the numbers that Americans get them.
So that brings us to January. A lot of things are happening on the ground, getting rid of the primaries. We know Carter Page came to Trump Tower and talked to Lewandowski and Clovis and apparently start thinking, hey, this is a great guy to bring onto our presidential campaign. I don't know how. Stephen Miller, the former aide for Jeff Sessions, joins the campaign. And the Russia contacts are pretty low, but what we do have is a really bizarre email from Michael Cohen to, like, the publicly listed, like, an email address of Dmitry Peskov, who was, like, the Putin spokesman. So, like, it's, like, the one, let's like, press@russiagovernment.ru, that kind of deal. And Cohen writes, over the past few months, I have been working with a company based in Russia regarding the development of a Trump Tower Moscow project in Moscow City. Without getting into lengthy specifics, the communication between our two sides has stalled. As this project is too important, I am hereby requesting your assistance. I respectfully request someone, preferably you, contact me so I might discuss the specifics of it, as well as arranging meetings with the appropriate individuals. I thank you in advance for your assistance and look forward to hearing from you soon. Which, again, what the fuck? Like, this is, I mean, okay, this project is too important to, like, to let fail, is what he's implying, but, like, Why do you think that Putin's going to get back to you on this little business venture that's stalled out? Especially, there's something more going on, yeah.
Yeah, especially when Trump has announced he's running for president you know, one would imagine, you know, if he won, that he would not be making a deal like this, you know, that he would not be in charge of his companies at that point. You know, one did not realize at that point, one being me, by the way, that he would just completely flout the norms and expectations and constitutional rules, and he would remain with his ownership of his companies. But again, you know, why is he pursuing this in the midst of a campaign?
And again, I think there's more, like, has to be, this is not just a normal deal. There is something connected to the election about it. Or maybe that's just how the Trump organization operates. But there's no reason for Putin to think it's so important unless there's more going on.
That's really the question, is why would this be, what's in it for him? Why does he care?
Yeah. And I mean, maybe there's some like finance issue. I mean, who knows? But I think we'll learn more as time goes on. Anyway, that brings us to February. Caucuses kick off. Trump doesn't win the first one, but is close second, starts doing well. He's a pretty early front runner. And then at the end of February, Paul Manafort emerges from his European exile to re-enter the field of American politics. And he writes a letter, or writes like a sort of talking points to people he knows in the campaign to get him brought on as an advisor, basically in part because he has experience in sort of rounding up delegates and making sure that no one screws over Trump at the convention. But he's the one who reaches out first. And I think there's questions there about why.
I believe there have been allegations against Manafort in the past of vote rigging in primaries or in terms of delegates. But obviously, I don't know that anything came of those allegations. But that would be the time for his, if he had that particular skill set, for him to use it.
But he's been out of politics for a while, too. Like, he didn't seem to have any interest in American politics. He's been out helping dictators abroad. Why now does he decide to re-enter the field? Maybe he just, you know, seemed like fun at the time. But he wasn't asking for pay. And again, if you're not paying, you're the product. So I'm not certain. We're not going to find out at some point that Manafort was instructed to do this. Anyway, we have Jeff Sessions, the first major endorsement to go on to Team Trump late February. And then suddenly people realize, like, actually, yeah, he's winning a lot. Actually, yeah, we are in deep trouble. And the Never Trump movement starts to form, sort of a belated reaction to the horror facing them.
Actually, this is a very important time on this timeline that actually Susan has left out, is when I started tweeting anti-Trump messages. this is the moment, actually, when he started gaining momentum in the primaries. When I, you know, again, it's ridiculous that this is missing, Susan, because this is when I went on The View and said that Trump reminded me of Charlie Sheen in that he was somebody who would just say crazy shit off the top of his head, and that we probably didn't want that for president. But again, it's missing from your beautiful chart here, Susan, sadly. A notation of the fact that when Trump started picking up momentum in the primaries, that this is when I started tweeting against him.
You were the never Trumper.
Exactly.
When John Pryor took notice is like what's missing.
Exactly.
From
that's
yeah.
That's nowhere on this sheet. And that's a huge omission.
If only you tweeted sooner, we could
exactly.
have all avoided this.
But I also went on The View and said that that like Charlie Sheen, Trump was somebody who would just say stupid shit off the top of his head. And that was probably undesirable in a president. And I stand by it. I stand by that statement.
Your analysis is right on. That's exactly what he's like. And but, you know, it worked. And I think that's around the time that, I mean, I had been tweeting and but we had all been doing it kind of as a joke. I mean, we thought this is like, this guy is going to be the sideshow to like the main event. And he'll just be the Sarah Palin to the, you know what I mean? It's what keeps you just kind of like scratching your head and saying, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. But not a serious threat at all. Just, it was pretty horrifying as like the realization dawned that this is actually happening.
Isn't there a South Park episode about that? We didn't take it seriously.
I got to see that.
Anyway, we get to March, and this is when things really start to kick off. And this is like more and more certain that Trump is going to be the nominee, which I think is an important fact to remember, is that in the timing of all of this, again, like Russia has, other than the Putin comments, Russia has not overtly gotten behind Trump in any way that we've seen. But at the same time, Putin's involvement here, Russia's involvement in this election, is going to depend a great deal on who the actual Republican candidate is. I think whoever got the nomination, Putin would have been doing variations of what was happening. But if, say, Jeb Bush had been the nominee, it would have looked a lot different. What they could have done with the emails they obtained and the hacking and all that, it would have been very constrained. And I think that the whole strategy was developing in tandem with the sort of the course of the primary election. But in March, that's when sort of this the hacking mission sort of kicks up a notch. And that's when we have Fancy Bear in the picture. Before it was like Cozy Bear. Now we got Fancy Bear sending lots of phishing emails to a lot of people in the Clinton campaign and in the DNC as well. Which again, Cozy Bear is already in the DNC. But we also have George Papadopoulos. By about March 6th, he learned he's going to be an advisor. And he says that, or at least the filings against him say, that he came to understand from the beginning that a principal foreign policy focus of the campaign was an improved U.S. relationship with Russia, which, interesting. And then he is over, I don't know why he's in Italy and London and all that, but he is. And he's over in Italy and he tells Professor Mifsud, who I think is still missing, that he's part of the Trump campaign. And suddenly Mifsud's like, oh, actually, I do care about you. Let's talk. And this evolves to a meeting with Putin's niece. It's not Putin's niece. Apparently, this dude's so stupid, he's like, doesn't even check to see if Putin has a niece before taking a meeting with her. So they meet in London. And the whole time, Papadopoulos is sending updates. Like, he's telling people back home in the Trump campaign what's going on. This is the March 24th email where he tells, we know for sure, at least Clovis and Charles Kubik and at least five others. And again, subject is meeting with Russian leadership, including Putin. And talks about how his contact Mifsud, who introduced him to Putin's niece, they're all, you know, they're friendly. And Russia wants to talk to Trump. And waiting to hear everyone's thoughts on moving forward with this very important issue.
Again, this as an idea to have some sort of relationship with Russia be sort of the centerpiece of your foreign policy. Again, you know, it's gross because Vladimir Putin is in charge of Russia and, you know, he's a, you know, murderous tyrant. But but again, none of this is necessarily evil. I mean, it's misguided and immoral. Well, I guess that rises to evil.
Also, they hate us. Also, they hate us and want to destroy us. They could. Yes. So like they're not our friends.
Yeah.
They're a little tiny economy the size of Canada and they're evil. So let's not make them like the priority here.
Yeah. But my point being that he's saying that the focus, their foreign relations focus completely is becoming allies with Russia, would seem to indicate that that's what the whole, you know, that's like the grabber of the whole campaign, is that that's their big rethink, is we're going to be allies with Russia and just take over the world, which, of course, harkens back to his what he wanted to do back in the 80s.
And it does have other implications, too, like especially all the Iran hawks they had in that team. They're like, let's separate Russia from Iran. That's how we'll do it. So it's not just about Russia necessarily, but Russia's like the centerpiece of this crazy scheme. But then we have the March 31st National Security meeting. And we know that Papadopoulos gets up and says, hey, I'm George Papadopoulos, and I can get Trump a meeting with Putin. Which Sessions says he now remembers this because he pushed back on it and said no to the idea. But like he'd already emailed them in advance and said, subject line, meeting with Putin. So it's not a surprise what he's saying. Like if they're actually against what he had to say, they wouldn't tell him to come to this meeting on 31st. He told them a week before what he was up to in London. And total side note, but I want to bring it up because I'm still like weirded the hell out by it. The other foreign policy advisor that's gotten a lot of airplay is Carter Page. He was not at this meeting. And according to what he told Congress, he couldn't be there because he had, quote, a previously scheduled meeting with some of the top U.S. military commanders many thousands of miles away from Washington.
Why? Why are people meeting this guy? I don't understand.
I don't think we can assume they were, but like no one asked questions. Like he said this and everyone in Congress is like, cool, keep going. Like, wait, like can we nail down some specifics here? Like, what are some of the top U.S. military commanders, and why are they meeting with you thousands of miles from D.C.?
Yeah, it is fascinating the number of what appears to be just straight up con men are involved in this administration, and you know it's the circles that Trump seems to travel in,
and he falls for them too. Because like, I mean, Jesus Christ, how could anyone like? I know there's useful idiots, but they have to be useful.
They can't just be idiots.
But that brings us to April, and going back to Papadopoulos, we know he's in London and he meets with the professor Mifsud, his, you know, the little quote-unquote professor. And this is I'm actually a little bit skeptical maybe that this is the exact timeline of how it went down, because this is coming from the filings in his case and it's not necessarily a reflection on the what really did occur. But he says he was in London and met Mifsud, and Mifsud said, hey, I just got back from Moscow. I met with the big wigs there. And they have thousands of Hillary's emails. They have all this dirt. They have everything. Now, remember, this is before there's been any kind of public acknowledgement of this. In March, March 19th, I think, they got into Podesta's campaign manager's email, kind of the sort of the, I guess, their holy grail, really, for this election cycle. But no one knows about that. And it doesn't seem as if it was caught yet. And then that's late April. This happens. And he, the Russians are telling the Trump campaign, albeit they're like their little low-level guys, hey, we got these emails.
So they knew before anybody.
Well, it's not really clear what, I mean, they knew before the public knew.
But we also don't know which emails they're referring to. You know, it seemed like often at this point in the campaign, the emails that Trump was referring to in his speeches and such were the lost Clinton emails, the ones that had been scrubbed by her law firm when she had to turn over her emails for the Benghazi committees. So them saying they have Hillary Clinton's email, it's unclear. Is it those lost emails, or is it that they have access to her campaign?
Yeah, and it's possible if Miff said, like, we don't even know exactly his role here. It's a lot. I mean, he seems like he was definitely kind of a cutout, but he may not have known exactly what kind of emails. But of course, everyone, the Trump campaign is so obsessed with Hillary's 33,000 State Department emails. They all assume it's that. Like, no one even thinks bigger picture here. And they hear dirt, they hear Clinton emails, and they all think it's the 33,000 State Department emails. So it's not necessarily that there was any kind of misleading going on, or that it just the Trump campaign couldn't hear what they're being told. Back up a bit again. In April 19th is when Ted Cruz was mathematically eliminated from taking the nomination himself, straight out. And then right after that, suddenly we have the first confirmed overtures of saying, we got dirt, you want dirt, we got dirt. So what we know from the Russian side is that on April 12th, someone tries to register something called electionleaks.com, but they screw up like the registration, doesn't happen. But then the same person, a week later, April 19th, registers dcleaks.com, which will be one of the outlets that start leaking hacked emails as the election goes on. So they're already getting into gear for publishing this stuff. Publicly, though, there is no knowledge of this extra hacking going on. We know from Comey's testimony that he said late 2015, he knew what was happening. And I think there may have been more activity going on about Trump than we know. We know that late 2015, so again, this is 4 months earlier, at least from this point, our like allies overseas, like our intelligence partners, like the UK, is sending reports to our leaders saying, we have lots of contacts between Trump and suspected Russian operatives. What's going on here? And they already know as of very end of 2015, by they, I mean FBI, American Intel Services, already know that there is a sustained Russian hacking campaign. So we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but they had to have known something was up here. Maybe not that Trump was involved, but they had to know what it looked like the Russians were trying to do. But before that's public, we have Papadopoulos being informed by Russia that they have the emails. What we don't know yet is if he passed that on to the campaign. The campaign says no. Papadopoulos doesn't say either way. What do you think the odds are that someone in the Trump campaign heard that the Russians have dirt on Hillary and they didn't mention it to anyone else?
Yeah. And we know what their reaction was later when they got the Goldstone email. We know that was their attitude then. I refuse to believe their attitude would have been substantially different earlier.
Yeah. And this little guy who does want to make a name for himself and is trying to talk himself up, like hell, he's going to hear from his Russian buddy, this big intel, and not pass it on the campaign. So what we need to know, and then one of the things will come out before, too much longer, next few months, is what happened when the Russian contact told Papadopoulos this. Who back home did he write to? And given that his emails at this time were to Lewandowski and Stephen Miller, I think that there's more to be heard there. I would put the odds at like 99% that Papadopoulos went back and told them they have the dirt on Hillary.
Why the heck wouldn't, of course, I mean, in no world would that, I mean, anybody would, to be honest. I mean, anybody
I'm
would.
Curious.
Yeah.
And I'm comfortable assuming from like at least this date onwards, I think that for all reasonable purposes, we can assume the Trump campaign is operating with the knowledge, they believe, the knowledge that Russia has Hillary's 33,000 State Department emails, or at the very least has emails about her. Now, they're mistaken, obviously, as to what emails Russia has. But I think from April 26 onward, that's kind of a focus point of the entire campaign, is how to get those emails, if not sooner, assuming they didn't know even before Papadopoulos had his little London adventure. And this, obviously, given the sheer amount of Russia contacts Trump had, it's going to take longer than expected, which means this may be a two-parter episode.
I am looking forward. I'm still holding my urine, by the way, and I will hold it even if it takes us another week to record the second half.
And my infant is totally on his own. I don't know where in the house he is, but this is so riveting. This is definitely going to be a two-parter. We're going to have to come back and continue the timeline here, because there's so much more to be discussed and so many more leads to follow in this thread. But basically, let's see, where are we on the timeline? What's the date? Where have we ended up?
We are at just before the Mayflower Hotel speech.
All right, sounds good. All right, well, thank you so much, Susan, and John Cryer of Undisclosed Fame. I'm so sorry. That was like the worst introduction I gave ever. I really apologize.
No, I'll take it. I am incredibly
Emmy award-winning actor, director. Anyway, but thank you guys so much. And John, I hope you can join us again to finish out all things Russia that Susan has put together. And we'll be back next week with the rest of this.
I refuse to miss it.
Awesome.
Excellent. Okay.
See you guys next week.
All right. Talk to you guys then.
Thanks.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.